coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK.
Worth doing badly.
Welcome back to Worth Doing Badly. This week, we will look at the lessons for the 18th Sunday after Pentecost, according to Series B of the three-year series lectionary. And they are Jeremiah 11, verses 18 to 20, Psalm 54, James 3, verse 13 to chapter 4, verse 10, and the Gospel according to Mark, chapter 9, verses 30 to 37.
Ethan, after last week and your focus on words, this week captured my attention, and I'm going to focus on one word, paideion, child, and particularly its connection with the English word pedagogy, and which is has to do with teaching. Now, and the thing I want to focus on is what Aquinas called potentiality, that the human being is the actual human being, but there's also the sense of the potential human being that we see in like marriage vows, where you commit yourself to the person in front of you and recognize that that person has a future of potentiality, which you are now committing yourself until death do you part. And so this whole thing that the child becomes the image of this potentiality, and to try to spell out what that actually means. Now, once again, the text begins with the disciples arguing, but in this case, they were arguing about who was the greatest, which is absolutely crazy, because they just heard Jesus talk about that the glory of God will be embodied in his death and resurrection. Greatness, glory, the eternal glory of God will be manifested on the cross. And they completely missed it. And I think that they just were not able to handle the truth that Jesus said that eventually he would end up being crucified. It was just so out of the realm of possibility that they immediately switched to the exact opposite of the cross, asking who is the greatest. And then Jesus is going to go on to show them how embarrassingly irrelevant their concern about pecking order is, because the whole world is being turned right side up. That's what righteousness is. The world has fallen on its head. And if we want to be at the top, when Jesus turns it around, we will be at the bottom. And that's what this text is about, is talking, is kind of showing what it means that the world, that Jesus is turning the world right side up. It's making it upright. It's that's what righteousness is, the cosmic righteousness. So Jesus makes it clear they would have to be the last, and by the last he means they would serve others. It's amazing to me that people, that the most selfish politicians still call themselves public servants. In which way they are servants, I don't know, because they like bossing people around and doing all sorts of things which aren't actually service. So, and Jesus himself says the people call themselves servants when in fact they are, that's just a word that they use to disguise the real truth of which they are power hungry and enjoy having power over others. So, again, this is a text that Mark is presuming that when it's all said and done, God will flip the script. He'll turn things over. He'll reverse everything by this crucifixion that then resolves in the resurrection. And so the topsy-turvy world is becoming untopsy and unturvy. And what does that mean then? So Jesus says you want to see the implications of it, and he takes a child and puts it in the midst of them and said, if you receive this child in my name, then you are receiving me. That is a saturated text. So in other words, the child is at the top. The child is the greatest, when in fact, there's absolutely no evidence. The child at that time was considered something just above property. A father of a household could choose to kill the child with impunity. children had to prove themselves to be worthwhile, then they would count. So Jesus makes it clear that you receive the child in my name. And that's, again, a saturated word, which means it will not make sense to do what I'm telling you unless you see that it is centered in my life, teaching, death, and resurrection. So in other words, this is not natural philosophy. This is not something that's going to make sense on its own right. This is going to make sense because it expresses the truth of the incarnation and particularly the crucifixion and resurrection.
That charges the incarnation with even more significance, that there was, even from an early age, Jesus had the threat of death hovering over him, that he could very easily have been done away with, you know, and dispensed because he wasn't found to be useful or hadn't proven himself as a child.
I mean, then you see the beauty of how the Christmas celebration has taken over when you recognize that because children are not useful, they are considered liabilities. And in our day and age, people are refusing to have children because they believe that children are inimical to happiness, right? That's just, again, crazy to think that you can have a society that has any length of staying power at all without having children. And yet that's our experiment. And hopefully the experiment will come to an abrupt end. But it does capture the fact that when you look at the child from a certain angle, it is not the first. The child is a liability and is something that threatens our own personal happiness. And that is, as I'm saying, it's because we live in the world of actuality rather than a potentiality.
Okay. Right?
And again, this is the brilliance of the recovery of Aristotle and by Aquinas, is that this whole area of potentiality, if that is really true, if possibility it governs our future and not scarcity, not death. If you live in a mortal world, everything is moving towards death. But if you live in an eternal world, everything is there's possibility for everything, because reality is not confined to between life and death. It's life, death, and resurrection. Now, where do we concretely experience that? That is in pedagogy, right? That is in what happens if the child is really at the top of the pecking order, is really the greatest. Then you'll recognize that that child cannot remain who it is. That actual child needs to be trained and taught and molded, and whatever metaphor you want to use, the child is going to need teaching, right? There is no such thing as realizing potentiality that doesn't involve discipline, the discipline of a disciple, right? So if we really do believe that all of us are the children of God, then our lives are defined by us actualizing the potentiality that has been given to us by faith. I first approach a text and say, what is the telos? What is the word that is being declared here? And then I ask, what is the telos? What is this word striving for? You know, our discussion of the word therefore last week, that pushes us in saying this word is striving for embodiment. And here the telos is, as we said, the potentiality of the child is expressed in pedagogy. The church's prejudice is for potentiality over actuality. And so that means the child needs to be, a beautiful word, educated, educare, that there's something within the child that needs to be brought out and mature, or in the word instructed, that there's an inner instruction, there's an inner restructuring that takes place. And what this requires, if we look at the history of pedagogy in the church, it requires institutions that are patient, that can patiently discipline the child, you know, year in and year out, to actualize that potentiality. That's why the church's focus on the family is so crucial, because the first actualization of the potentiality, it takes place within this family. Now, if you don't live in a world of potentiality, If you're not living in the world of, as Jesus says, in his name, it doesn't make sense to give up the present for some future that may not be even true. So this prejudice towards potentiality, I think it explains why we in the church seem to have a strident opposition to abortion, which actually seems to, which seems to ignore the actual hardships and sufferings that are involved with this. Those are really actual hardships and sufferings. And yet, the church is against the abortion because we live in a world of potentiality, that the fetus is all it needs is nourishment and time. And so that being said, yes, it looks like the fetus is inimical to someone's personal happiness, but there's more to this. But again, we can't expect the world to accept our prejudice, which is simply to see the world from in Christ's name, from his perspective.
I've been reflecting recently on how Christians in the world should reflect a greater maturity. I feel like in general the world is stuck in immaturity, right? And sort of like a child, not a childlikeness, but a childlike immaturity, that we're more set on getting things for ourselves, of satisfying our desires, and that we're stuck. We're not, culturally or societally speaking, we're trapped in this quasi infancy and not moving on to adulthood. We're failing to see the potentiality that we have as individuals, even in a wider society. So I guess what my question then is how does the church lead the way? How does the church articulate a way forward in maturity and greatness that might be contagious to the rest of the world?
Well, my default is always Paul's definition of love, right? That in order for the church to be the church, it has to function by people loving what is there. Not so obligation is secondary. And of course, we would say a child doesn't actually ever love these things. You don't love using the Greek language until you have worked through the arduousness of tables and memorization, right? Nothing mm-hmm. can be loved that you haven't learned. And so what I really like about Paul's definition is if we really believe that our potentiality is just another name for growing in love, that means the church has to be a place of patience and kindness. And I am saying that knowing full well that those are two qualities that do not come naturally to me, especially when I feel like I'm in the right. And I wish if I could relive a lot of circumstances, it would be to say that the things that I desire to take place are not going to take place without patience and kindness, because what I desire is to love these things, and here I am trying to force them. And part of my love for the institution of the church, at least the invisible church or the ideal church, is the fact that I have concretely been served by the patience and love in elementary school. And I didn't like it at the time, but in that elementary school, they taught us all sorts of things. They forced us to be in choir and sing, and which meant going to having to sit through three services singing, and which was crazy actually. And eventually it when you had sent them, you get a little bit higher, they forced me to take languages and in all of these things, there was this kind of patience with me, that saying you've entered into this door and you there is so much potentiality that can happen, but it will happen because you are within this institution. And eventually, the message got through that the actual world is less important than the potential world. And so you prepare yourself for this potentiality. And the beauty of the present is not that you deny the present, is that you just see that the present is connected to an unfolding future, which is what I, how I define hope, that this thing is gaining momentum and I'm participating at this present time in something which is becoming greater and greater, just like a child, as you like the word maturing, that this maturing is taking place. So the psalm, what I really like, now this may seem ridiculous to focus on this, but the beginning of the psalm says, for the lead player on stringed instruments, right? So this pedagogy is not going to be, you know, a STEM sort of education, of which, you know, concrete mathematics and number. It is poetic, right? And this poetry, that the expression of these truths happens poetically and musically, that this is what this religious life is about. And it is that this ascent to the glory of God is going to work a lot the way that poetry and song. But what I really like is the word, the lead player. Now, we know that when God gets in your heart, a lot of music is produced, and most of it bad. So what happens here, now we don't want to say that God in your heart shouldn't produce music, but it doesn't mean that all the bad music is the highest expression of the glory of God. And so this psalm says, these are instructions for the lead player. This is, you're going to try to do this as well as possible. There are standards in this place. And so the lead player of the stringed instruments is going to lead in this. And again, this Jesus says, in my name, and here again is talking about the name of God. This is a reason why we believe that there is real rescue, that God really does take up our cause, that prayer really is a meaningful transaction because of God's name. So what does that mean? God's name is what is the reason we believe in creation, that the world moved from ex nihilo to ad nihilo. It moved out of nothing and into something. And that the creation, by virtue of the salvation, is now moving not towards ex nihilo. It's not moving towards annihilation. It is moving towards fulfillment and completion. Right. So when we talk about the name of God, that is the reason why we believe that even though physically we are wasting away, life, which is greater than the physical, is actually gaining momentum, just like a symphony gains momentum and is moving towards its resolution and its end. And the psalm makes it quite clear. If you don't live in that, if God is not set before them, right, if your world is not discerned by the reality of God, you know, if you cannot say hallowed be thy name, then the implications are that this world is a life of winners and losers. It's an agonistic struggle, right? There is no resolution. There is only limited resources and way too many people going after it. And consequently, those who see that are adversarial and oppressive. And the psalmist prays to be freed of this adversarial relationship. That can only happen if, in fact, God is really there. Now, the side I really liked about that, if God is really there, then this life, and I don't mean to be demeaning of this life, but this life is more like a game, right? That if we really have salvation and the life to come, then this life is like playing a sport of sorts where there are limits and there's a set time period. And the joy of this life is playing this game as well as possible. And the game is, you know, embodying the truth of God, and of living this life in God's presence. And there's a joy that the psalmist recognizes in this life, even because we are not living under the conditions of a world without God. So And in that, if there is salvation, the psalmist recognizes there is also the demolishing of those things which work against salvation, that the actualization of potentiality means that evil is being pushed back and goodness is moving forward. And the way that that is signaled is, it's crazy, but the psalm says that if you actually see this metaphysical, this cosmic movement towards completion, the most obvious evidence is that people will offer free will offering. People will freely worship. Now, everyone thinks that our worship is irrelevant. God doesn't. God thinks if you're there freely and expressing freely your prayers and the truth, that is the greatest sign in that individual and among that congregation. That is the greatest sign of the truth of the world of potentiality becoming actual.
How big of a role does that freedom play? Because you were talking about sort of the, perhaps the compulsion you were under in elementary school. How does that jibe with the free will sacrifice?
Well, I think it's obvious that had those teachers not freely done what they did, I could not have become who they were. So it wasn't my freedom. It was their freedom. And I have to say my best teachers embodied the patience and the love that Paul, the patience and the kindness that Paul, that are the corollaries of love. Freedom isn't just an individual thing. Freedom is something that a community shares. Now, Jeremiah, it gives us only, two verses here. And again, it is this whole thing of that if to be, to see the arc of pedagogy, to accept it that we are moving towards the realization of potentiality, that requires an authority. We need to be told this is the way it is because the actual experience is not going to feel at all like the realized potentiality. And so Jeremiah says he felt like a gentle lamb led to the slaughter. And I don't know that my schooling ever felt like that. I wasn't a gentle lamb. I was an obnoxious lamb. But at any rate, he accepts this. I did not know it was against me. They were devising their schemes. He says, these people, if you're living, you don't have time to scheme. The schemers have all the time in the world to figure out how they can steal and destroy these things. So if you can, but you can't worry about them. You can't create conspiracy theories about them. Rather, to live in this knowing that God is continually teaching us is to be able to even enter this violent world as a lamb being led to the slaughter, because God is doing his work in heart and mind, right? This is where this work is being done. But to believe that, that requires the gift of faith, that this is actually going on inside of me, and that what is taking place in heart, soul, and mind is the actualization, the slow actualization of this beautiful potentiality that we see unfolding in all of the Gospels. We say, what is this potentiality? And it's the life of Christ. It's the teachings of Christ. And this is why I just love the slow way that we work our way through these Gospels and work through the synoptics to catch the different nuances, because the life of Jesus is a vision of our own potentiality, living in the presence of God. All right, James. And as I said before, James helps us get over our allergy to the word therefore. If this stuff is true, it will have effect in this life. That's what the word therefore it will happen. The logos will always be searching for a telos to be embodied. The third part of my sermon preparation is, what is the eros? Why should I want this to happen? What is lovable about these texts? What is desire about these? Right now, so James approaches the whole thing from the negative. What is the cause of quarrels? Why are you fighting? I think any church that has split will be very keen to ask this question. What was it about our quarrels and fight? And I think that there's an inability to actually see that those fights and quarrels were not a manifestation of righteousness, that more than likely they were manifestations of what James says, an inner condition, that the passions were at war within you. And the passions being at war, what James, he defines it. He says, passions at war within you is when your desires are not fulfilled. You desire and you do not have, and so you become angry. You murder, right? That you have the idea of weeping and gnashing teeth, that when the desires are not fulfilled, we are simultaneously filled with rage and with sorrow, right? And James says, you covet, but you don't obtain. And when you do obtain, it doesn't really help, right? And so you fight and quarrel because you are unfulfilled. There's a bitterness inside of us. And, you know, as I said, we're so ready to say, no, well, I'm fighting for the truth. When in fact, it may well be that the fights and quarrels are what James say they are. They are signs of an incompleteness, an inability to recognize that our potentiality is not in this life. We are participating in it. We are moving toward, but it is coming. Our true life, this life, is like the false start that we'll see in the Olympics. It's not the real race. The real race is yet to come. So James is making it clear and saying, look, here's what's going on. We need to be living in the life of prayer that you don't have because you don't ask, and you don't ask because you don't believe asking does anything. And so what would it be like to really live in the presence of God, in which, you know, we talk about the real presence and we quarrel over it. Give up quarreling over and start experiencing it. If God is really present, then asking God for these things, the fulfillment of our desire, or at least the patience to wait, is the most reasonable thing in the world. And in fact, as we said earlier, prayer and worship are not irrational, superstitious signs. They are the signs that we live in a world that where it is reasonable to hope. And one of your themes that you continue with, Ethan, is what James says, in order to live there, you humble yourself. Right. You don't worry about who is the first, who is the greatest. Rather, you see the cosmos for what it is by becoming down to earth. Humble is related to the word humus, which means dirt. So if circumstances actually drive us into the dirt, it may be that that is a gift in which we are able to get a better view of our potentiality. It's returning back to the original dirt that God created human beings from, in speaking to that. And when we're returned to that humbleness, that is the beginning of the most remarkable path towards the realization of potentiality.
Thank you, David and Ethan, and thank you for listening. All the podcasts from this series, Worth Doing Badly, are available from our website, lutheranradio.co.uk. Try our app, download it for free from Google Play or the App Store. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other program on our schedule, send me an email to manager@lutheranradio.co.uk. I am your host, Jamie Krieger, and I will be back next week with David and Ethan. Thank you again for listening, and stay on for more here on Lutheran Radio UK.